Welcome all to the our first colloquy for the year. So the idea of a colloquy is actually it's an interaction. So the point of it when we initiated it is that we don't have someone present their own paper. So that no one's an expert in the field, and everyone else is everyone here to learn. We all contribute to the debate. So my role is merely to chair, which is to encourage people to say things and make interactions. And if ever we find anyone who talks too much, I'll ask them to talk a little bit too little. But we haven't yet in, this is I think the sixth colloquy. If you would use the microphone, it is recorded and people can listen to it. The names are not included. I mean, in a sense, names are not attached to the voices. So you may be recognizable, but in a way, we're operating under sort of Chatham House rules. You can talk about what you can talk about what is said, but you should please not ascribe any ideas to anyone who has said them, on the basis that this is a time to think about things, not about to take formal positions. So if you want to make a position, you know, raise a question or make a point that you regard as outrageous, that's quite all right. We can deal with that. So we'll start off with Martin will give 5-10 minutes perhaps on the introduction, but I think there are quite a few slides and we might well stop and discuss them as we go along, and we'll see how we go on that score. The idea is that we will be finished by 2. If conversation runs out before then, we'll leave early. We'll stop early, but the idea is that we should be free-ranging and allow the conversation to run on. Please, if you have something else, feel free to leave. You don't have to stay rooted until 2 o'clock. I don't know whether they're CPD points, but if you're here for the complete hour, for at least an hour, I'm sure you can count it. So without any further ado, over to Martin to introduce the topic. Well, sorry.
Okay, thank you very much. And as Anthony said, I've got a few slides prepared, but probably we'll just go through them and talk about issues as we go through, and feel welcome to raise issues that are not on any of the slides as well. Just a quick bit of background on myself. So I've worked with Anthony on the equity risk premium, not this year or last year, but the prior 2 years to that, which is the annual survey that the Institute does. We've just finished our sixth survey, and that should be out published in the next week or so. And my background is predominantly working in the equity markets, but at the moment actually working more on the bond markets for war cover insurance, where predominantly the assets there are in the fixed interest markets, and also working with the Securities Exchanges Guarantee Corporation, which is the trustee for the National Guarantee Fund, which is there to back up if you do a share mark trade on the ASX and something goes wrong, as in what happened with BBY, you can make a claim against that fund. So we head on to equity risk premium. So the topic today is the impact of low interest rates and short-termism on discounting and the equity risk premium. So just looking at what the interest rate environment means and what the current situation is and how that's affected, particularly the two papers from the central banks, how it affects investment decision-making and allocation of capital in the real economy. And the first slide, which is probably a good one to start some questions and some debate, is actually just what do we mean by the risk-free rate? And the first one would be, and we'll get into sort of the expected return on the risk-free rate in a moment, but should what we've seen particularly around the world for some countries during the GFC, where government bonds sold off very much, and basically were particularly in places like Greece, where they weren't seen as necessarily as risk-free. And just when assessing the risk-free rate, if we should make, instead of just using the government bond and we'll probably discuss the term that you might use for that government bond going forward, but should you make some allowance for default rate on the government bond to work out what the risk-free rate is as the base? And I suppose what you've seen a market developing in CDSs and also including sovereign CDSs. And this data is just from on the Deutsche website. They give current CDS rates for governments. And has Australia 5-year CDS at the moment set at 24 basis points. And there's implied loss given default, and that gives probability default, which they have at about 0.4 at the moment. So I suppose the first question is, when we're looking at the risk-free rate, I suppose we get to the question is, are the government bonds the right thing to look at risk-free rate? But should we allow for some deduction for default risk even off the government bonds? Does anyone want to tackle that question?
Just a question. Is the point 4% simply a mechanical outworking of the 24 basis points, or does it divide up the 24 between true estimated default cost and risk of accepting or risk of default, like risk compensation to the investor for the risk of accepting the possibility of default?
As far as I understand, the 24 basis points is the 0.4 probability of default times a loss given default. And you can actually choose, on the website, you can choose different loss given defaults. So presumably that's a 40% loss given default for that calculation.
Yeah, okay. So de facto, it assumes all of the price for the CDS is effectively best estimate default cost.
Yeah, so as I understand, the 24 basis points per annum would be what you would deduct from the government bond rate on the 5-year to get a risk-free effectively rate for Australian government bonds.
Yes, it wouldn't be the probability of default, because it would be a huge risk premium in the CDS. It's a real heavy tail.
Yeah,
I suppose the question to me was, why do we want the risk-free rate? If we're going to say we're going to discount insurance liabilities at a rate that represents zero risk at a much higher, much more security than the government, is that right? Or should we actually have implicit, we should allow some risk for defaults of an, if the government's going to default, insurers surely should be allowed to do so as well.
I would agree with that. I mean, it's a separate point, but yeah. So I think on the basis of just that point alone, I would argue not that you don't need to deduct anything from the Australian government bond rate.
Any other comments on that? Well, I suppose at least the main thing is people are aware that the government bond rate does have an implicit default. People won't assume it's zero. Obviously, where you've got your own central bank and own ability to issue currency effectively, default rates are much lower. So if you look at, say, US, UK, Australian bank central CDS, I think, between the 15 to 25 basis point type level. But when you go to particularly the European currencies where they're not issuing their own, European countries not issuing their own currencies, obviously Greece, Portugal, et cetera, the CDS rates are much higher.
I think that that's a different situation.
Does anyone know who's buying them?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I did actually try and look up sort of traded volumes, etc., when I sort of had that up there, and there seemed to be sort of, there was only a few older papers I saw, 15 to 20% of traded volumes in corporate and sovereign CDSs. So sovereign CDSs seem to be reasonably big, reasonable market, but probably relating more to hedging out Greece bond risk and other bond risks. I'm not sure about how big the Australian market is.
Was your question who's buying Greek bonds?
No, who's buying Australian CDSs?
Yeah, I suppose maybe people were selling Australian CDSs at 24 basis points and pick up extra yield as possible. But obviously you only get 24 basis points and you've got quite a big downside if things go wrong. So. Okay, then we talk about the definition of EIP or equity supreme, and I think this is quite something to think about. So the paper by Bianchi, Drew and Walk, and also for our annual equity risk premium for the Institute of Actuaries, we define the equity risk premium as the difference between the expected return on equity and the expected return of the risk-free asset. So in a way, we sort of leave open to people to think about what the difference may be caused from. And I suppose what I'm saying here is that it's a bit different from conceptually from getting to the risk-free rate and then adding on the equity risk premium for some risk premium sense to get to the return on equity. So I think if you leave the definition as the difference between the return on equity and the return on fixed interest or debt markets or the risk-free asset, that opens up for interpretation much more broadly as to what, you know, ERP or what we might call the equity risk premium really is, and therefore more debate: is it a risk premium or is the difference between those two expected returns due to a number of other reasons? So maybe some comments on that. You've got some comments on that, Anthony?
I can, but anyone else, anyone like to respond to that in the first instance?
Short-term question, Jane.
Yeah.
Okay. One sentence question is going to be repeated by the answerer.
Okay.
But on one level, those two definitions are the same thing. So is the difference more sort of the first definition is a more dynamic or produces a more dynamic equity risk premium, whereas the second definition is arguably a more static and stable equity risk premium? Or is there some other difference that I'm missing?
From a sort of pure mathematical perspective, obviously it's just changing the equation around and you get expected return on the risk-free rate plus an equity risk premium gives you expected return on equities. And I suppose in a way that's what people often use the equity risk premium for. They say, what's the equity risk premium? And they add it to the risk-free rate and say, oh, this is what we expect the return to become on for equities. But I suppose what I'm suggesting here, and you know, this is obviously probably a different view to normal, and hopefully get some conversation going, is that makes you sort of think about equity risk premium as being an equity risk premium, as in you've defined the term being the difference, and therefore you're saying, I suppose I've called it positivistically, you said that's an equity risk premium. Now all you're thinking about is what are the reasons for an equity risk premium, how big it could be. But I'm really saying that, and we'll get onto further slides as we go through, that you really should just be looking at your expected return on the equities and then take away, and then your expected return on the risk-free asset, which is obviously an easier exercise to determine. And that gives you the equity risk, what we call the ERP, and that equity risk premium or ERP might derive from numerous components, some which we might not ever understand, some which we might be able to understand.
Thanks, Bob. I mean, one needs to get very clear in your head the difference between the realised equity risk premium, what's actually happened historically, and the prospective equity risk premium is what we anticipate in the future. And the way this focuses, I think, produces that focus on... and then the I can't remember the guy who did it. I mean, it might be Fernandez sort of saying the difference between the projected implicit equity risk premium in the market, where you take the earnings yield minus the interest rate, which in a sense is an implicit That's what equities are going to do. And the projected one where you look at share prices and future profit growth. So there's quite a range of ways of looking at it. Quite important to be relatively clear what you're trying to do. Do you want to talk about Richard Fitzherbert now or later?
Yeah, we can talk about announcements.
Maybe we can, Anthony just mentioned that it's the Richard Fitzherbert paper which we had in as one of the readings. And as I understand his paper, he's basically saying that equity returns derive from company earnings and how well companies invest their capital, and that's really the long-term driver of equity returns. Obviously, the price you pay for equities at a certain time may influence that return from equities over the short term, but the long return that comes from companies is the return of capital that they generate on themselves, and that sort of really defines the equity return, or the expected equity return is largely focused on the capital generated, return on capital generated from the companies. I suppose that comes down to this slide here, which is why is the difference between, so it should be bond and equity expected return rather than the bond. So when we do expected returns from for the risk-free rate, if we're basically going to say that's a government bond rate, which seems reasonably well, most people are happy with that, it becomes an IRR calculation of the coupons and the face value at maturity and potentially adjustment for the reinvestment rate on the coupons, which is the you're reinvesting on coupons might be less than the or more than the IRR. Then you have a question as to should we allow for a default rate, which we spoke about before, for government bonds. And just a point here on if, you know, bonds used to be issued with a sinking fund, which is sort of quite an actuarial concept, because then the bond effectively becomes an annuity. And in that situation, obviously, default rate is, default risk is mitigated. But without a sinking fund, default risk becomes more to the fore. When we're looking at expected returns on equity, which is, again, an IRR-type calculation, the question comes to what should we be doing the IRR on? And I think this is where you get a lot of the debate starts to come through as to what the equity risk premium is and the size of it, etc. And it's probably fair to say that there's a variety of views of, and even though I've managed equities and been a stock analyst for a long time, there's different views as to what people should use or you should use for doing a evaluation, IRR type calculation on equities. So probably the most common one would be a sort of a net operating free cash flow type approach. And the reason why that's probably more common than, say, reported earnings is that depreciation is often quite different. Depreciation allowance is often quite to the required amount of capital because of depreciation as a historical cost type basis versus more a current basis for the capital in any business. That said, the key focus from a lot of investment reports is on reported earnings or normalised earnings or normalised earnings per share. And I was also reflecting that often it's just 3 years type forecasts, which is comes to this sort of short term. Like as a stock analyst, you might be asked for 5 years occasionally. You tend to model a long way out. You tend to model about 15 years, but that's just to make it easier to update your model for the following year so you don't have to create a whole extra year for the following one. So, but generally investors are predominantly interested in sort of maybe 3 to 5 year earnings forecasts. And then dividends, obviously, they're the easiest one to calculate with your IRR, per se cash paid out. And I think this is a common error of valuations where operating free cash flows are valued even though they include retained earnings. So it's actually quite difficult to do a cash flow evaluation of a company because you've got to make sure you're not double counting retained earnings in the valuation. And then you've got questions on imputation credits, how they should be valued for the short term and the long term, and then capital gains tax or other tax benefits, you know, should they be included in your IRR type calculation for equities. So I suppose that they're just some of the issues that I've thought of in terms of equity IRRs, and I think this is where a lot of the foundation comes to the issue of why some people have much higher expected returns from equities or much lower expected returns for equities, because there's a lot of debate as to how you calculate the equity expected returns.
Sorry, what I didn't ask is how many people work in which, where people are going to be using the equity risk premium. So who's involved in investments? Anyone? Portfolio construction? Right. They obviously don't use the equity. Sorry. A little bit, yes, all right. And in valuation matters, using the equity risk premium for valuing future risk cash, okay. Pricing, okay, so we've got, what am I missing? Channel interest. asset allocation, okay, asset allocation. Sorry, I just, so for, for the guys who are involved in pricing, I think Richard Fitzherbert's insight, which he's very idiosyncratic, I suppose one should say, that the paper to say that the equity risk premium is generated by the companies. But I think he's got a good point in the sense that the return that the return that your company is going to earn on the capital employed is going to be based on the target, the hurdle rate that you use. Is that right? So the hurdle rate, is the hurdle rate right? How do you choose the hurdle rate? And perhaps some of you guys involved can say how you're choosing the hurdle rate.
In a lot of cases, somebody important says, this is what I want to earn, and that's what everybody targets.
Right. Does anyone have
a different approach to that? Has any, to your best of your knowledge, how long ago did the board revisit the hurdle rate?
In this particular instance, I won't answer, but in a lot of cases of which I'm aware, it's a very static assumption that may stay the same for 10, 15, 20 years.
Greg?
I come from what I think is probably a slightly different background, which is the one that comes under the heading of fair pricing as it's applied in things like CTP insurance, mandatory regulated forms of insurance, for example. Now, these have a history that go back to the 40s in the US. That's where the theory for this originated. It was originated by academic economists. And the whole idea of this is that because you insist that the public must purchase some product, and then you underwrite that product in a commercial market, you must compel the marketers to undertake what's called fair pricing, in quotes. And all of these things, like hurdle rates, anything at all that's internal to companies is anathema in this field. It's supposed to be an objective measure. Now, obviously, there are lots of difficulties in deciding what's objective, but the whole starting point is that you do not adopt parameters that companies specify. So for earnings on capital, you would never adopt a hurdle rate.
You would adopt and expect, but you would have an equity risk premium in there?
Yes, certainly, yeah.
And would you?
But it would be empirically determined. I mean, there's all kinds of problems here, and I don't want to champion one approach over another. So you might use CAPM, you might use Farmer Fridge, some of those capital pricing models. And I don't think it's very productive to go into whether one or other of those is better. But you do something like that, and that model would be parameterised on the basis of history and so on. And this, of course, begs the question of whether history is a good indicator of the immediate future or even the long-term future. But anyway, I don't want to keep going on about it. I'm just making what I think here is a very fundamental distinction in methodology.
Well, I mean, I think it's really important because, I mean, for one instance, you would find that therefore with lower risk-free rates, prices would come down.
Lower risk-free rates?
So, yeah, and you kept the same equity premium, the interest rates would decline in your pricing model.
Yes, in those cases, the hurdle comes down.
Your target profits would decline.
Yes.
And so your prices presumably would come down.
Not necessarily.
Yeah, of course, with the lower discount rate, the risk premium, the risk premium means a different thing here. The expected cost of the insurance will increase, but the profit margin will decrease.
Sorry, the expected profit on the...
I guess what you're trying to say here is that if the risk premium decreases and you probably have a fixed ERP, then the expected return on equities decreases as well. And that's factored into the equation, yes.
So we're saying... Ron Harroy, who... was started up at Australian Eagle here in the 70s or where it was. He said Jim Anderson, when he wrote his paper on profit testing in 1959, used a discount rate of 15%, and actuaries are still using it. Is anyone using 15% still? I love people. No.
Just the banks.
Sorry?
Just the banks.
Just the back one, yes.
Well, I think our CEO announced it. Target of 15% in the analyst briefing last week.
That 15%.
Well, I don't know if they've changed, or perhaps they have changed, but there was a time, say 10 years ago, I'm not sure if I'll get these historical parameters exactly right, but there was a time when it would have been reasonable to assume a risk-free rate of, let's say, 5%. And equity return of 12, perhaps. And at that point, companies' hurdle rates were probably about 16. And they may have changed now, but there was certainly a transitional period where the 5 risk-free rate dropped to 2.5, say. And for those who are following the protocols that I outlined a short time ago, the equity return, the expected equity return, dropped in sympathy. So it would have dropped to say 9.5, but the hurdle rates were rather sticky, and they remained at 16% for quite some years. It caused quite a bit of friction actually between regulators and insurance companies.
And I think that's the nub of the bank's problems. It still continues to be at that high level. Sorry, do you want to carry on?
I've seen an increasing sophistication in pricing models where the regulatory capital requirement is done at a risk-free rate, and then any economic capital required over and above that is charged at a much higher rate of return, which can be these quite high sticky rates, where it's sort of saying if we're going to allocate capital within the entity, within the group, we want to get this much return on it. So beyond what's statutorily required, if there's capital that's got to be employed, then we're expecting a quite high return. So there's that double-edged model now, I think, where there's not just a single rate of return expected on the pricing assumption, but on a, how the capital's employed.
Seeing you've raised it, now the banks are now being asked to put in a whole lot more capital. Is that being priced at the new, how they see, I mean, can you tell, are you able to say what they're doing with their targets?
Not from the banking side of things. I'm more on the life side than on the banking side. So how that's all happening, I'm not over familiar.
Lucky you.
I choose my fights, yes.
Just while we're on the topic of sticky rates, I probably should also say, bugbear of mine is sometimes actuaries tend to use sticky rates on the risk-free rate as well, where instead of using market-based measures, they use a actuarial-determined long-term interest rate. And so I haven't checked up in the last couple of years, but for example, federal government superannuation liabilities were done at sort of actuarial rate and then revalued through the budget the period after. So I suppose that's one thing to think about also is, you know, should, you know, these sort of long-term sticky risk-free rates be used as well?
I speak under correction, but the New South Wales government uses a discount rate of 7% real for its projects internally, with a 4% and an 11%, I think it's 4 and 11 sensitivity. I don't know if anyone's done work for New South Wales, but that's clearly, to my mind, that is why you are waiting. It takes you longer to get to work.
Okay, and then the second slide of the difference between that. So, again, coming down to this equity IRR and trying to calculate that, the key factor which I mentioned earlier, which is the reinvestment rate on retained earnings from companies. It's a very important assumption in any company valuation. And like obviously when you think about Berkshire Hathaway, probably is the ultimate stream of this where they haven't really paid, I'm not sure they paid out dividends last year, but over a long term not paid any dividends. So if you try to value them on a dividend discount model, you might have been in a fair bit of trouble. And it's really been how well they've reinvested their earnings and their profits over a period of time, which has led to the strength in that business. So obviously that's a key component. Then obviously you've got, similar to the bonds on reinvesting your coupons, how the rate that investors reinvest their dividends at, and tax as well. And just again, this is a bit of theory, so people should or may have differing views. But I'm from more of the school of value subjective, and therefore it's individuals determine value on their own. And there are a lot of factors as to why someone might want an income stream or a likely income stream at which they apply themselves. I mean, they're the buyer, maybe become the buyer, marginal buyer or marginal seller. Helping setting the sort of the bidder offer price for a company or for the equity markets. But given it's a subjective type issue, that means it's very difficult to sort of objectively measure what it may be because we can't know what everyone's subjective view is as to why they want to buy or not buy those equities.
Sorry, I would add, if you read Warren Buffett's annual letter, which is actually really very worthwhile, he says, and I have no reason to doubt him, that Berkshire Hathaway is the biggest investor in infrastructure in the US at the moment, and he's taking advantage of, well, he has a low discount rate. So he's investing in infrastructure, which I think says a lot.
Okay, and then we come on to expected return of equity. So I suppose the first question I pose, and I have no answer for this, is if bond yields were stable, would equity yields also be stable? And later on, we'll have a chart which looks at sort of the last 140 years of US bond yields and US dividend yields. But the question comes to sort of how much of the instability, if you call, the follow-on from that is the equity risk premium is meant to provide compensation for some elements of volatility or uncertainty or whatever. But if bond yields were stable, would equity yields become more stable? And that's, I think, open for question and debate, and maybe we won't know because we haven't had stable bond yields for quite some time. But I think most people probably agree that equity cash flows are more unstable than bond cash flows, and therefore maybe less sought after by the marginal investor, and that's probably a reasonably good component why the return on equity should be higher than the return on the risk-free rate. But maybe we can hand that and open that for questions, discussion.
I'm not sure that the expression, because they're more unstable, they're less likely to be sought after. If you've got a guarantee 2 every month versus maybe a 2 or a 6 or a 10 or a 6 or a 4 or a 6 or a 10, the upside is far greater potential and therefore potentially more attractive. So they may be less stable, but is there greater upside in the equity cash flow than there is off a bond cash flow?
Isn't it relative to the expected value? So 2, 6 and 10, if the expected value is 6, you may not value
all of it. That
as well as a guaranteed 6 because of the possibility of the 2.
Perhaps another way of saying the last two lines on that slide is that if you factor in investor utility and you believe in positive risk aversion, then the equities don't need to be less sought after, but equal upside and downside fluctuations don't produce a value of zero relative to the bond yield. And so that immediately implies a premium. Whether that accounts for the whole premium is another thing, but it certainly implies some.
If you look at equities, fundamentally the price is determined by supply and demand, and you can look at that at many levels. And therefore, over the long run, you would expect that there is some variation in the equity premium as a result. For example, I know questions are asked: why are we now in such a low return era? Stepping back from just the immediate, well, the central bank did this or the central bank did that, why are we in that low return era? Demographic waves, meaning that there's just a bulge of baby boomers, etc., who have funds to invest, who will run them down over time. But that's a demographic wave that's in all advanced countries. So that's part of the reason why there's just more supply of capital and maybe less demand, I think over a longer period you would expect the equity risk premium to actually vary. Because it comes down to utility. If people have money, they have to invest it, so put it somewhere.
The other dynamic, obviously, is that the cash flows are uncertain. I'd say most of what you observe as differences in realised equity risk premiums isn't a difference in a risk premium. It's a fact that the actual earnings, whatever underlying measure you choose, the outcomes are different to what people expected it to be. So we can't actually observe any of that because it's all expectations and nobody knows what the market's expectations are.
Well, we're following
the tech bubble wasn't about people's risk premium going down. It was people thinking that earnings were going to take off, and they were wrong.
Also, just a comment on company earnings in an aggregate sense. Just generally, they develop from sort of bottom-up stock forecasts to get sort of EPS forecasts for S&P 500, etc. And what you generally see, sometimes you see rising EPS forecasts, but the general trend is for EPS forecasts to go down as you get closer to the actual time. And again, what are potential reasons for that? But part of the reason, I think, is that equity analysts tend to forecast sort of more sort of regular state, and there are more negative events that come along to affect company profits than positive effects that come along. So therefore, I think that's part of the reason why you do see a decline in company earnings. So again, any valuation or where you're calculating the expected return on equity shouldn't necessarily just use those EPS forecasts. You've got to make an allowance for how they may be overstated compared to actual. And also, quite often they're based on normalised type basis earnings rather than reported earnings as well. And reported earnings are closer to the cash flows that the shareholders get over time, most likely as well. Now, this is one on payment media. So I suppose one of my interests is in sort of monetary economics. And I think when we're viewing any of these things, particularly in a long-term context, we should consider what the payment media is. And from my perspective, I see that is probably the primary sort of difference between equities and bonds and debt. And therefore may well explain, you know, large components of particularly, I suppose, what we're seeing as the historic levels of equity risk premiums that are paid out in market. So if you go back long enough, bonds used to be payable in gold coin and gold bullion, but basically, well, probably since the 20s for most of them, bonds are now paid in the payment media issued by the central bank. And it's also worthwhile keeping in mind that the central bank's payment media, which is its liabilities, are often backed by the bonds on the other side of their balance sheet. So in a way, it's a bit of a funny situation. And then you've got to think about how you get paid, how the government generates the money to pay you the payments coming out of the bond you expected. Obviously, taxation is one component. Creation of that payment media is another one, which we see fitly through actions like QE. And then, which is becoming more and more common, is just basically the refinancing is the way that governments are repaying their debt effectively on a gross basis, but not through the payment of, not through the sale of goods and services. While with equities, they're deriving their cash flows, which are obviously flowing through to what you're valuing the expected return on equities through the sale of goods and services. And those companies will be demanding the medium of exchange effectively in that time as to which they're operating in. And that may well be the same medium of exchange as the bonds are issued in. But over time, companies' prices tend to go up with you know, price increases, or people might call inflation. And effectively that's why debt is seen as a nominal asset and equities are seen as a real asset. And we can talk about inflation-linked bonds, which is effectively trying to convert debt into a type of real asset. But I suppose the question comes here, are you really comparing a nominal asset to a real asset when you're trying to change the difference? And that's part of the difficulty in having any stability in the difference between the two. Sure, that must open up some questions and debate.
No? Stop.
Anyone like to take new monetary economics? The view that the... government can always tax, so it's always got the ability to can always stop inflation by just forcing people to pay tax and forcing people to take their cash. And the states that have failed, like Zimbabwe, and hyperinflation is when the government stops taxing. It's got the right to tax, you don't get hyperinflation, which is perhaps one of the explanations for why we don't have inflation with this huge money creation. Marginal economic debate. Good question. Here's a question, though. Are equity returns linked to inflation? How are equity returns linked to inflation?
Total company earnings should, in general, go up in line with inflation.
And have they?
Yes, I think. not having looked at any data.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't work in this area anymore, but I've certainly had debates and, you know, sort of quant. I think quant investment people will often say that there is no correlation between equity returns and inflation. I don't believe that. I think that over the long run, inflation must contribute to equity prices, but it's a complex dynamic. For example, you know, if inflation increases, that creates a more difficult business environment. Historical cost accounting and stuff distorts earnings, etc., etc. So it's actually quite a difficult dynamic to empirically measure, I think. But I'm sort of with Anthony in the long run. It must be some effect.
I haven't done any work on this. My first thought in answer to your question, which I thought for a moment might be a trick question, was that if one thinks in terms of, in the usual terms of price inflation, wage inflation, and productivity, and an equation connecting the three, and assume some kind of stable environment in which these parameters move, then the inflation causes variation in factor inputs in a business, including labour costs, and prices vary in sympathy, and creating a direct correlation between inflation and profits or share earnings. So if you think along those lines, then any failure in that correlation derives from some failure in that defined system. That there's some form of instability that in the system that prevents profits shifting in line with inflation, for example. But as to empirical evidence, I really don't know.
My understanding is that there's no correlation, but there is co-integration. But the correlation is almost impossible to work through, and something comes to the breakdown in the interaction, but there's the co-integration that eventually the indices will move together. There's a pull that the indices should be okay, but actual year-to-year fluctuations or month-to-month fluctuations are just so noisy that they don't produce. So I think there's the co-integration argument, I think, is my understanding, is a better way of modelling it, for instance. I remember noticing that in the UK in the 70s, their inflation tended to follow wage rises because of the power of the unions, while in the States it tended to follow price rises. Well, it was just price rises because, in fact, it was companies pushing their prices up to maintain their profit margins. So it depends on your not to maintain, to increase their profit margins. So if you've got sort of inflation means competition in the market, people keep on putting up their prices or their wages to try and better their share of the economy at the expense of others.
That's why Japan doesn't really have much inflation, because they're not so greedy. I think that's my explanation. But I think so. That's your mechanism. I think your mechanism is actually right, Greg. That explains the noise.
From my perspective, obviously, there's a lot of different theories what inflation is, from a monetary theory to other type theories as well. That's probably not worth going into here. But just in terms of extreme examples, it's sometimes good things to look at it. And I think Venezuela is a good one to look at the moment, where they're obviously going through very difficult times. Their currency, the bolivar, has gone from, I'm not sure, 10 to 1 to US to 2,000 or in that sort of order or something like that. And their share market has gone from, again, I'm not sure, from sort of 1,000 up to 32,000 or so. So obviously in US dollars, I think their share market has been creamed. But in local currency, their share market has done really well. And obviously, a component is that you're actually owning some, not sure what the companies are, some petroleum companies, et cetera, who are selling their goods in US dollars and therefore earning some income, so therefore they're more highly sought. And people are not seeking to hold their money in bolivars because you can't buy much with it. So I suppose an extreme example that shows that the equity market in your local currency is highly correlated with inflation, but in a US dollar sense might have done poorly. So this, we sort of touched on this already, which was basically, are they sort of effectively different things, and therefore not particularly reconcilable? Next one we'd just like to have a discussion on is stability of the risk-free rate. And this is probably a theory you haven't seen. And if you look at the central bank papers for this meeting, a lot of them were saying that, you know, interest rates are coming down. Why aren't people investing more in capital investment? And this is the theory that suggests that so really the stability of the interest rate, which is most important for creating a healthy market. Obviously, a low and stable interest rate is probably the best of all worlds, but a fairly set interest rate. But the theory is that falling bond yields actually create distressing markets and therefore make people potentially less competitive. Yeah, that's a theory why we haven't seen as much capital creation, or we've actually seen some capital destruction, and potentially why there's been more deflation than inflation, despite the amount of sort of new money coming through the system. And then the other one would be that instead of money going to capital investment, the money's really gone into bond markets. On the basis of capital gains you've been able to achieve from buying bonds and selling them back to the central banks, given the central banks have indicated their intentions to continue buying a government bond through QE-type programs. So this is a reasonably contentious theory. But so it's more like a stability of interest rate theory for capital development rather than the benefits of falling interest rates.
Yeah, there is. I mean, you just look at the takeoff in infrastructure funds in the past 12 months, and obviously the impact that that's had on pricing of infrastructure assets. So people are looking for return, and that creates a demand.
And so we should be seeing more infrastructure funds and more infrastructure bonds.
And you are. And you're also saying quasi-infrastructure.
Sorry?
You're also saying quasi-infrastructure, which is a totally different topic, but quite interesting.
the market is responding in some way.
I just had a question about the previous slide, actually. You quote the source of the theory in the slide. Given that the expectations of quantitative easing, which have been breached in these examples, derive from the monetary theories of Friedman and Coe, and so in other words, derive from an existing theory, one would expect that a counter theory would explain why the previous one broke down. Does it do that?
Yeah.
Sorry, so, yeah, this is a very good question. And basically, the Friedmanite type theories and Keynesian type theories and a lot of monetary theories and even the Austrian theories, the Mises Institute, the main Austrian theories in the US at the moment, are very much based on the quantity theory of money type concept. That's their theory of money. So the more money in the system, the more inflation. And that's been, I suppose, as Anthony said, hasn't come through. And a lot of people were questioning as to, why with all this new... Like in Australia, we've obviously seen property prices, but not less so in sort of day-to-day good prices, but to an extent. But around the world, particularly in places like Japan, despite their best efforts of, amazing efforts to increase the money supply, haven't really seen it come through in CPI-type measures. And therefore, that sort of quantity theory of money that potentially hasn't really worked out. So Professor Paquetta's theory, which comes from Karl Menger, who was the first of the Austrian economists, is more like a quality theory of money, so rather than quantity, so which is basically, it's largely gold and silver are the forms of money, so it's the quality of the money, not the quantity of the money. So that's, I suppose, from my perspective as well, that a lot of the economic problems we've got into in terms of QE and other theories, other, Abenomics in Japan, have been driven off the quantity theory of money. And that's proving itself and will probably prove itself to be a very poor theory. This slide here shows you the last 140 years of US 10-year government bond yield to maturity, and also that, I'm not sure, presumably it's S&P 500 all the way back there. I'm not sure when it started, but if not, it might have been Dow or something like that. Dividend yield. And I suppose this was interesting from that stability perspective. Also raises some issue as to, for quite some time, the dividend yield on equities was higher than the bond yield. And then, obviously in the last 20, 30, 40 years, we've seen incredible volatility, although, in quite trend sense, coming through on the bond markets, and we're seeing dividend yields, at extremely low levels compared to bonds until recent as well. So, and I suppose just from my perspective there, when you are looking back on long-term bond yields, you should keep in mind that those bonds, again, probably prior to sort of 1915 or probably the First World War, were generally paid in gold generally gold. So it's quite a different it's the end of a sequence of the bond markets when you look back there.
Just minor point is that the drop in the dividend yield in the late 90s, early 2000s, I think, was tax driven, and it's the change is tax driven in the States, so they didn't go as far as that.
maybe from 1870 they paid their money in bonds, but I've just been looking at prepaid bonds in gold. But governments traditionally went bankrupt quite frequently. This is slightly irrelevant, but the chief executive, the prime minister of the Netherlands in the 1600s was called actually the chief pensionary. And the guy, Johan de Witt, who actually occupied the post before being thrown out by William III of Orange, was an actuary. I mean, he did calculations and he had big arguments about how they priced their annuities. He unfortunately he and his brother were assassinated. So it's not quite true to say he's the only actuary that I know of who died in the course of his duty, but it makes a good story in that score. But part of the problem was they didn't pay their debts. Governments have historically gone bankrupt quite frequently.
Well, I suppose that goes back to the first slide. You should be allowing that for that 0.24 at least. And this slide just is about the stability or instability of the equity risk premium. So if we argue that stability of the risk-free rate is very important for capital healthy generation, then it comes down to the stability of the equity risk premium and how that's influenced. Obviously, one example we're seeing in Japan at the moment is where the Bank of Japan is targeting or close to zero on its 10-year, so it's creating its own stability of the risk-free premium as well. But obviously, we've seen from that previous chart big volatilities in returns on the risk-free rate. And probably even the inflation-linked type securities are one option for investors to try and get some real asset exposure and reduce, I suppose, mitigate inflation risk. But even there, we're seeing quite a bit of instability in that market. We've even seen some negative yields on inflation-linked securities. And so just out of interest, the current yield in Australia is around about just under 1.2% on inflation-linked securities, and it got down to about 0.2 three or four months ago, 5 months, 6 months ago. 0.2. And this is our final slide, so hopefully we've got some more questions and debate to come up, and maybe some people can talk about the overall issues that arise from the discussion today. But this just looking at how real interest rates have reduced over the last 20 years. And then I suppose coming to the real question for today was how low interest rates and equity risk premium have affected capital decision making for business to go ahead with projects.
Sorry, I did this quickly this morning. So the Google Images was the place that I could find the last 20 years of interest rates. The two sort of need to be looked at together. So TIPS is the US one. Went negative for 2012, 2013, and is back at, just slightly negative at this point, but more. We've already started looking at it. We've talked about the fact that low risk-free rates should lead to lower hurdle rates. We've talked about the fact that they're sticky in our experience. Now, both Andy Haldane and Philip Lower both said that they are worried that the stickiness is one of the reasons why we're not getting investment at the level that we expected. So the practical questions are, is that right? And should we be doing something about it? And if so, what?
So long as people think it's a short-term aberration rather than a systemic change, then they'll wait for things to improve.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you've got this temporary change, and people may well hold off. If they believe it's a permanent change, then they will live in the new world and make their investment. So maybe we need to convince people that this is the new normal.
Okay. Is it the,
is it the new normal?
If it's
question.
The new normal, okay, that's perhaps a question. Is it likely to turn around? Is Trump going to turn interest rates positive by borrowing a lot? Who knows? I mean, Graham was talking about demographic changes. I mean, it's also the fact that I think the Chinese have $2-3 trillion of American Treasury deposits, the government has. So because the Chinese have been growing so rapidly, they've had difficulty in spending the money, so they've saved it. So I think that's another pressure. So sovereign wealth funds that tend to invest in short-term cash deposit type arrangement, treasury bills, also pushed interest rates down or allowed interest rates to remain low. And then on the demand side, the big companies, Google and Amazon, certainly Google and Microsoft are operating on the basis of no capital. I mean, they don't need investment. They just push a button and they duplicate what they're doing. So a lot of the new investment has been very, very capital light and inventory light. So there's the need for new investment has dropped, with infrastructure being the exception. So maybe that is one of the, there are a number of things that come together to make it the new normal.
Just make a general comment. I think part of the stickiness of hurdle rates is that perhaps the consumer side of the economy is ill-informed or doesn't realise that it's these hurdle rates that they're paying too much, particularly in the Australian economy. There's a lack of competition, and that the hurdle rate's sticky because that's what the companies can get away with. And if they all agree that it's 15, well then it's 15. And consumers, unless they go and do something about it or empowered or understand that imbalance will stay. And I just don't think that the hurdle rates are any more than whatever they can get away with, the companies can get away with. So if the banks can get away with 15, if the life insurers can get away with 15, they will. Until they get pressure from the consumer side, it won't change.
Okay, I mean, why then do CEOs of various sorts to then set the target rate high? Now, do they not see it as a long-term change? Do they not consider fairness? Or are they actually driven by investment analysts who want them to say that they're going to target 15%?
Who must be the first CEO?
What's it?
Who wants to be the first CEO to go lower than the rest? Do you think there's a macho perspective to this?
But there's also, I don't know, that at an individual company level, an individual company isn't flush with capital. They've got every company is capital constrained to a degree, except maybe Microsoft. And so it's not a question of what's the minimum value adding point. It's a question of how many opportunities are there, and let's rank them at the top, and we stop where we have used up all our capital expenditure capacity. So if a company's targeting something above a value creation point, it's perfectly rational at an individual company level. The question is why isn't there additional capital coming into the system to create new competitors with lower thresholds?
And why aren't they raising money at 15%? If that's the cutoff point, or 13-12%?
If you look at credit card interest rates, it's a good example. I mean, credit card interest rates could be an awful lot lower if there was a lot more competition for amongst the consumers to chase the credit card interest rate down as opposed to allowing them to get away with it. In the life insurance space, whilst the Act requires priority of the interest of policyholders, there's nothing in the Act that talks about equity between policyholders and what's a fair and reasonable charge. So you get you know, funeral bonds that are charged at ridiculously high interest rates, and direct marketed business that has incredibly high return on capital rates, but are very overpriced compared to what they are and have all sorts of problems with them. You know, where is the appropriate measure and performance, and where should that be? It's left to the individual companies, and yes, if they can screw an extra couple, they'll screw an extra couple. All the performances are measured on new business sales, not on how the in-force business is managing. It's all about new stuff.
I'm not sure that's quite the right characterisation of what they're doing. They're trying to maximise returns for their shareholders, which are the super funds that we all invest in.
I would also add, just the same flavour, but fundamentally, if companies, for example, did just lower their hurdle rate for investment, and perhaps for pricing their loans if they're a bank or other products, then ultimately that means that their earnings go down, and their share price goes down. So, you know, it comes back to the fact that if your share price is set essentially based on the fact that, for example, you're an oligopoly, then you have an inbuilt incentive to remain part of that scene.
Jeff, do you want to respond to that? Is that on? Yeah. Two things. Your earnings don't necessarily go down just because your hurdle rate goes down. You might sell more stuff, make more money. I mean, but the other point I would say is we do see, as an example in the life industry, the Japanese or Asian-based insurers are now creating a bit of competition, particularly the Japanese, because they have negative interest rates in Japan. They come to Australia and at least they can get a positive return, and their hurdle rates are less sticky and more responsive. And when you look at who's riding the business, and I'm only talking about the group business, where there is actually some consumer pressure, that is going more to the to those sort of insurers that have dropped their hurdle rates. And they're not the bank insurers.
I don't disagree. I mean, fundamentally, this is kind of where competition, I suppose, comes into play.
I mean, coming back to my assertion that that there isn't a lot of sort of new money coming in, I guess the flip side is there aren't new competitors coming into sort of aspects of the market. So a few years ago, we had the non-bank home lenders. You know, more recently, there's peer-to-peer lending coming in. So, you know, why isn't credit card debt rates going down? You know, certainly personal loan debt is going down. Expect credit cards might be next, depending on how they manage to structure themselves. So there are people sort of investing capital to take a slice of the super returns that existing companies are making.
I think that's right. I think the life point, sorry, Jeff's point that the Japanese companies are coming in and buying up, we're looking at buying up quite a and foreign, the growing life companies are all foreign owned, and the Japanese are particularly enthusiastic here. So one either got to say the Japanese don't understand the mathematics of it, or the local people don't understand the mathematics of it. Now, it seems to me whether you believe in that the profits are monopoly profits or not, if you set a target rate that is higher than the cost of capital, you forego profitable projects. And so the fact that we're getting some competition from foreigners is a great thing. It's not so good for Australian companies, and not so good in a sense for the Australian economy, is that if we have unnecessarily high... If all our decisions for investing are set at an unnecessarily high hurdle rate, we're not going to do a whole lot of things that are otherwise important. I mean, the one that I think is most critical, which comes up particularly in Haldane's paper, they just mention it, is renewable energy. We put up a new coal mine, most of the cost is actually in rehabilitation 50 years out. if you have a 15% discount rate, it doesn't matter. While the costs of renewable energy are all upfront with no renewable costs, so you change the discount rate from 5 rial to 3 rial, and coal becomes incredibly expensive. I think that's one of the areas where I'd really like actuaries to get involved, and I think it's probably worth trying to do something in terms of talking the discount rate down. So anyone's got any ideas on that? Someone like to write an article? I think it could be it could be worthwhile. 10 minutes, yeah.
We haven't sort of discussed property today and sort of where it fits between bonds and equities is probably another long discussion. But certainly in terms of residential, particularly obviously apartments, we're seeing a huge amount of capital go into particularly the eastern seaboard states. Over the last 4 or 5 years, and that is at extremely low yields. A lot of the apartments purchase price are maybe a 3% gross return, and then you start allowing for other fees, and then allowing for some element of depreciation, which is obviously not caught up in property analysis. Then you're probably down to sort of 1% type return. And at that return, it's getting a huge amount of capital. So it's I suppose it's an interesting issue as to how some sort of business investments are not getting capital, but things like others are, as to what's driving those decisions.
I think there are differential returns at different levels of the sort of investment spectrum. So I think the investor who buys the unit may be getting 1%. I think the developer who built them probably made a bit more than that.
But investors are still buying.
But the investors are selling the same property in Shanghai for twice the price, so they reckon it's about as well. All right. Anyone else like to add anything? We're called tonight a day then. Thank you very much for your attendance. Recommendations for future topics and papers would be welcome. We'll have another two this year at some stage.